Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizing committee for putting together this symposium and the opportunity to come talk to you today. Before I'd like to begin, I'd like to point out that the handout lists James Muir is the corresponding author. He had to catch a flight and go to Brazil for another symposium that he was invited to talk to, and this originally was supposed to have been earlier in the week, so I'm filling in for Jim Muir on his behalf. Some of the other co-authors, Jamie Foster and Russell Jessup, are all from Texas A&M, and then at the Noble Foundation, myself, Cindy Interante, and John Biermacher in the Ag Division, who helped put some of the economic analysis together. So today I'm going to talk about cellulosic biofuel versus forage or feed, and with the concept of being without competition for food. And it's a very difficult concept, and it's very difficult to prove that there's not any competition, because these both cellulosic ethanol, feedstock, and forage are typically used on marginal lands. If we consider competition for a row crop land, I'm pretty confident that economics is going to drive the production. So we're not really competing with food crops, but when we look at biofuel versus forage, we are in direct competition. But one of the things I'm going to highlight today is that we can try to look at complementary systems basically give us an opportunity to be flexible based on economics to basically provide greater sustainable income for the producers in the region. So this group probably knows more than I do about cellulosic ethanol conversion. But basically, a feedstock is any plant that's converted to cellulose or hemicellulose after acid hydrolysis to produce a 5-carbon sugar or a 6-carbon sugar that can then be fermented and then distilled to produce ethanol. So if we compare that to a forage crop, a forage is any plant product that is grazed by a ruminant livestock, and the cellulose and hemicellulose is converted to glucose, which is then converted to volatile fatty acids, which is absorbed into the bloodstream and then produce protein or meat. So basically, a rumen is a natural bioreactor. The only difference between biofuels is the production or the end product of being ethanol, whereas a forage crop, the end product is protein or meat. So they're very similar. So my thesis today is that cellulosic feedstocks can and should be complementary to a forage system rather than being in direct competition. And today I'm going to highlight some of the projects that we're doing at the Noble Foundation, but also provide a little bit of a background on some of the history, highlight some of our research projects, and kind of talk a little bit about the future direction. Over the years, we've looked at switchgrass through various grants. We've looked at establishment primarily. We've looked at row spacing, seeding rate, planting date, cultivar evaluation, herbicides, weed control, looking at fungicides and insecticides, clean till, no till. But today, that's kind of like the agronomy of establishment. And some of the things I want to talk about today is using it as a complementary system for basically dual use, since we'll talk about some examples there. But before we get into this, to give you a little bit of background, originally forages were the original plants that were evaluated for cellulosic feedstock. They were thought to be suitable as biofuel feedstocks because they had already been bred for many years to be high-yielding, persistent, and have a high quality for nutritive value, with the idea that rumen digestibility and biodigestion are very similar. A plant that was high nutritive value would also serve as a good biofuel crop. So these are typically the biofuels come out of the agronomy or forage programs. So today, these two systems have always been in direct competition with each other, and today I want to try to highlight some of the areas where they can be complementary. If we think back about switchgrass back in the early days, the DOE reports from Texas, Georgia, and Virginia highlighted, and basically in this report they identified switchgrass as the ideal forage feedstock for biofuels, primarily because it had a lot more of the desirable attributes and fewer of the negative attributes. This graph just illustrates some yields, 5 locations across Texas, 3 in Georgia, 8 in Virginia, 2 in Arkansas, and 2 in Oklahoma, just to give you a range of the possible yield potential. Looking at the error bars just at the Texas location, yields range anywhere from 1 ton per acre all the way up to 10 tons per acre. So it's extremely variable based on the environment and how much rainfall you get. But on average, across all the locations, all site years, they averaged about 6 tons per acre. And so that was one of the reasons why it was identified as the potential forage that had the greatest potential for biofuel use. As I mentioned, it had more of the desirable attributes, the first one being that it was native. If a native plant was considered to be well adapted to a wide range of soils and environments, it was also found to be productive on low phosphorus soils, productive on low potassium, and basically it was adapted to a wide range of soil pH, and is also a long-lived perennial, which is very important for sustainability. But the bottom line was that switchgrass was selected over all the other grasses evaluated because it was generally higher yielding under those low input environments. This is just a brief study conducted by James Rogers at Noble Foundation, where they evaluated upland switchgrass, Dallas grass, Johnson grass, different types of love grass, Indian grass, Bahia grass, and Bermuda grass and Klein grass. And under no input, the lowland Alamo type switchgrass is generally always more productive than the other warm season perennial grasses on our marginal sites. So again, supports one of the reasons why switchgrass was identified as the species of choice looking at biofuel production. In the earlier days, the co-authors applied for some grants to look at some complementary systems using switchgrass both as a forage crop and as a biofuel crop. But originally the DOE funding was pretty much biased against this complementary approach, and the grant proposal was declined basically because they wanted to look at dedicated feedstocks only. So we basically did some of the complementary work on our own. But just briefly look at the history and kind of see where the interest came in. In 2005, after the billion-ton report, ethanol and biofuels became a hot topic, especially during 2007 when they had a spike in the oil price. There was a lot of interest in biofuels. However, in more recent years, when oil has fallen below $50 a barrel, there has not been quite the enthusiasm as there once was. I also like to point out that the futures price of ethanol is about $1.60 a gallon, and very similar to gasoline prices on the futures price, about $1.60 a gallon. I'd like to point out that the ethanol cost from a cellulosic, corn ethanol costs about $2.15 to produce, while from the energy.gov website, the cellulosic ethanol cost is about $5.26. So we can see that until there is a dramatic increase in ethanol yield from our systems or an increase in the cost of fuel, we can see there's not going to be a market for cellulosic ethanol, primarily because it's not going to be economical. And one of the things that I want to drive home today is that economics is going to drive what contributes to the system, and if it's not economical, it's not going to be adopted by the farmer because it has to be sustainable, and economics is one of the primary factors in determining whether it's sustainable or not. One of the other problems that we run into is that a lot of our feedstocks, the yields have been very disappointing. Most of the time, we'll have experiment stations and small plots on very high quality soil under irrigation, and we'll report yields of 30 metric tons per acre, or even switchgrass 25 metric tons. And so these two pictures don't exactly illustrate this point, but it does illustrate the variation in rainfall between a above average rainfall year in the top picture and a below average year in the bottom picture. And a lot of times we talk about feedstocks, we're reporting yields on these high quality soils, and then we can say, well, they're also adapted to our marginal sites, but when a producer plants them on a marginal site or shallow soil, we're told that they can yield this, and when in reality, they're getting about half that. So it's important that we understand the limitations and not oversell some of these oversell the yield of some of these potential forage crops or bioenergy crops. The other thing I wanted to point out is that a lot of times we say that things are very productive and they're adapted to marginal sites, but yet the yields that we report are often under nitrogen fertilizer. So we'll get, for most of our reports, and even in the research trials that I do, we're putting on nitrogen fertilizer. And we know that switchgrass can yield up to 200 pounds, get a positive linear relationship to nitrogen, up to 200 pounds of or 200 kilograms of per hectare of nitrogen, but yet we say it can grow with no nitrogen. And so when we see those reports, we have to bear in mind that when we don't put on fertilizer, probably can get about half of what we do. We typically report when we are putting on fertilizer. So anyway, so one of the things I'd like to highlight today is that bioenergy and forage crops, they can be complementary, but in order for them to coexist, they're going to have to be integrated. By definition, grasslands are marginal, so we're typically growing these in areas where we get lower rainfall, our soils are shallower, we have a lower fertility, as I mentioned before, and on those particular sites, we're not going to get the yield that we would get on the same species on a highly productive site. The other thing to consider is that there's other uses for the land. There could be wildlife or, you know, providing habitat. There's also hunting leases. And so if there's other sources of income, you know, they are in direct competition, but we also need to think about maybe it's not competition so much as it's a complementary system. So we have to take into account hunting, wildlife, forage crops, as well as biofuel, and put them into an integrated system basically to help the farmers and ranchers. You've heard from other talks that you can get ecosystem services. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but just to briefly highlight, we can improve soil health, we can increase carbon sequestration, we can improve the water, the hydrology by improving water infiltration and water quality. So we need to integrate these two into a system. Primarily, another reason why to integrate is being a diverse grassland can provide greater resiliency, can be more stable, and provide greater production, and also improve the seasonal distribution. One way of looking at integrating forages into biofuel systems is to incorporate legumes into the system. It's been highly touted that legumes can be a low-cost nitrogen source. And I've actually published a couple of papers. This particular data set has not been published because it basically provided the same information. But so we basically looked at two different harvest systems and looked at a couple of annual legumes and then compared that to four rates of nitrogen fertilizer. One of the things that we see is that if we want to use a complementary system, we typically want to make sure that we get adequate legume growth. But in our traditional system, we would hay off, we can get some legume growth. But in a biofuel system, and we'll talk about a little bit later why a December harvest after frost is more sustainable than the forage type system, because basically in the December harvest, we're going to be removing a lot less nutrients compared to a September harvest. So if we delay harvest until frost and then plant the legumes in the wintertime, we essentially have no legume growth. Or if we harvest in September, we can get some growth of legumes. I would say it's minor really in contribution to the total system, but typically we're not going to be able to do that in a biofuel system. So that integrated approach, in my mind, doesn't really work because it doesn't lend itself to be profitable. So another way to look at how switchgrass could be used as a dual-purpose crop or integrating both forages and biofuels is to harvest the high-quality forage early in the season and then let the regrowth go and harvest the lignified material, the low-quality of the biofuel. So you have a forage crop and a biofuel crop depending on when it's harvested. So we set up a study, and this was published by Carrington et al. In Crop Science, and we looked at three different harvest techniques. We either cut after frost, which is a single cut, which we typically recommend in a biofuel system. And we looked at two haying type systems. We either cut in the vegetative stage in June, and again after frost, cutting the regrowth for a biofuel crop, or cutting at the boot stage in July, and then again harvesting the regrowth for a biofuel crop. A biofuel crop. If we look at the IVDMD, the harvesting at the boot stage, the vegetative stage, provided a very high-quality forage, which would be acceptable for livestock. We also measured the percent nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash. And we can see that under these two-cut systems, we're removing twice the amount of nutrients that we do in the single-cut system. So based on the amount of nutrients that were removed and the value of the product, it's basically not economical to do this two-cut system. And this has also been supported by other researchers. Boyer et al. Reported the exact same findings in biomass and bioenergy, basically recommending a one-cut system, primarily because you can't afford to replace all these nutrients that you're removing in an earlier cut system. So another way to look at a biofuel forage integration is, can we look at incorporating a grazing system, basically grazing that high-quality forage early in the season and then harvesting that older lignified material at the end of the season after frost and taking the advantage of the fact that under a grazing scenario, we're recycling a lot of those nutrients and not haying at all, so we're not having to replace near as many nutrients. So we set up an experiment at the Noble Foundation to look at the effects of various stocking rates, and we measured average daily gain, feedstock yield, and total gain. Then we also, John Biermacher, one of the co-authors, is an ag economist, did an economic analysis using a range of potential feedstock prices as well as a range of cattle prices. So just kind of briefly go through some of the treatments. We had a low stocking rate, a moderate stocking rate, and a high stocking rate of 1 head per acre, 2 head per acre, or 3 head per acre. All the cattle were initiated grazing on April 29th, and these cattle were coming off a graze-out wheat system, which we typically have in our region. And then the cattle were either marketed either on July 19th, June 11th, or May 27th, and we calculated average daily gain, number of total grazing days, steer days, and got a total gain per acre. Then each of those systems were allowed to go until frost, and each of those were biomass was harvested. So we have no grazing yielded 6.8 tons per acre, and then the light grazing 4.7, 3.6, and 3.4. So we collected all the production data as well. We calculated establishment costs. We amortized that over the life of the stand of approximately 10 years. We accounted for all of our maintenance costs, nitrogen, chemicals, mowing, raking, baling, harvesting, all those input costs to calculate a total cost per acre. And then John Biermacher did a sensitivity analysis and basically looked at various prices of feedstock and various prices of livestock, but here, different prices of the value of gain. Here we're taking one of those values at 75 cents a pound, which is more of an average scenario. Based on the feed price and the yields, the value of gain for each of these systems, under the different scenarios, if feedstock prices are zero, which they currently are today, or even up to 25 tons per acre, the optimal system is going to be a moderately grazed system, which they provided a higher net return than any of the other systems. However, if the feedstock price increases between $50 and $75 a ton, the optimal system is going to be to lightly graze and then harvest the remainder of that for a feedstock only. Conversely, if the feedstock price increases to $100 a ton or greater, then the optimal system, which provides the highest net return, are going to be the systems that harvest for biofuels only. So looking at this, we can see that we have different break-even prices, but we can actually, depending on the markets, we can actually decide which system that we want to implement. So in the future, looking forward, we know that food production will take precedence over bioenergy based on simply economics, and that forage and feedstocks should be integrated to provide flexibility. One of the ways that we can do that, kind of highlighting that last experiment, we can graze early, we can harvest the lignified material at the end of the season for a biofuel crop. We have flexibility that we can graze out in dry years if we need to be. We can also harvest excess forage in above average rainfall years. This system will be similar to a dual-use wheat system, which we currently use in the southern Great Plains. Is anybody familiar with dual-purpose wheat? We typically graze it through the first half of the season, and basically from early November up until the first haul of stem under late February. Then based on the price of cattle and the price of wheat, a farmer can make the decision whether if prices of wheat are high, then I'm going to sell those cattle and grow a wheat crop. If the grain prices are low and the cattle prices are high, then we just buy more cattle and run cattle through the system. So basically it's just giving you flexibility, and that's kind of what I'm proposing that we do to integrate both forages and feedstocks. But keep in mind that all this is going to be based on market price. But the idea is that you've got flexibility and they're complementary, not so much in competition. So to summarize, biofuel crops and forages can be integrated and probably should be integrated to complement each other. But keep in mind that the economics is going to drive the system. Croplands are going to be used on our best soils because they have the highest value. Forages and biofuels, we're both going to compete on marginal sites depending on the price of hay or the value of gain of livestock or the price of feedstock. Until there's a market for a cellulosic feedstock, these marginal sites are going to remain into forages. And just to kind of briefly summarize, we have to be able to make a profit on these biofuel crops. The switchgrass feedstocks cost, in two different reports, In Oklahoma, Griffin et al. Out of Oklahoma State reported that switchgrass feedstock cost about $44 a metric ton, while in Tennessee, Boyer et al. Reported a similar finding of about $49 per metric ton. So until there's a market to pay that much for the farmer can break even, those lands are probably going to remain into forage systems. And so with that, I will take any questions that y'all have. Yes, sir. Versus what?
If you have Austin, then of course, but if you look at the convention,
I can't understand you. But you do have a choice. You can't mandate to a farmer that he has to grow something if he's not being paid for it. He's not going to do it. So you're saying that if there's an unfunded mandate. It possibly could, but until that happens, economics are going to drive the system. Okay, basically a bioreactor is converting cellulose and hemicellulose to ethanol through fermentation. It's a biofuel system. In a rumen system, we're converting cellulose and hemicellulose to glucose into volatile fatty acids, which are used to create a protein source for the animal. The idea is that you basically have two fermentation processes. They're both converting cellulose and hemicellulose at the exact same time. They're very similar, and that's one of the reasons that the biofuel arose out of the forage programs is because those systems are so similar. That was my point. Yes, ma'am. The question was, in the grazing systems, was looking at a monoculture or a mixture of switchgrass. These were monocultures of Alamo switchgrass. Yes, ma'am. That's an excellent point. And I asked that same question because, you know, the first cut is going to be higher quality. I mean, but it's not economical to do that. So economics are driving that everyone's pretty much accepted, oh, we have to do the after frost harvest because that's the only one. And it kind of reminds me of your comment earlier about cover crops. My definition of a cover crop is that it's returned to the soil. I'm doing a lot of cover crop work now, and the definition has changed. And so you mentioned the NRCS. They actually, in their new guidelines, say that cover crops can be grazed. I said, well, that's not a cover crop. That's a forage crop. Well, if it's not grazed, then there's no economic benefit. So everybody's changing the definition as we go. Miguel.
Improving switchgrass development in terms of the life.
That's a really good question. At the Noble Foundation, we had a partnership with Ceres, and we actually developed several upland and lowland switchgrass types, which were made commercially available through their blade label. It's called EG1101, EG1102. So there's two cultivars that came out of the Noble Foundation. We were in the process of developing a forage type and a biofuel type, basically leafy versus stem types. But due to political changes at the foundation, that program was terminated. So currently there are no active breeding efforts in switchgrass at the foundation, but there are still some programs across the United States. But at the Noble Foundation, we've decreased dramatically. All right, thank you.